It's Wednesday, February 6th at 1:03 p.m. Present today are Representative Olson, Representative Tarr, Representative Seaton, Co-Chair Feige, and myself, Co-Chair Sadler. Please clear your phones. They go off the darndest times. It does interfere with the system. If you have it on vibrate or quiet, so please kill them dead. There's two items on the agenda this afternoon, House Bill 4, In-State Gas Line Development Corporation, and HB 77, Land Disposals, Exchanges, Water Rights, called the Permitting Bill. It's my intent today to continue discussion on the gas line bill, HB 4, by letting the sponsor and his staff continue to finish walking through the sectional analysis. Then we'll set that bill aside for today and take up public testimony on House Bill 77. Representative Hawker is excused for the day. Again, we have his able staffer, Rena Delbridge. Please come forward, Ms. Delbridge, to continue your presentation you did so well at the previous meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. We left off on Monday partway through the sectional analysis of House Bill 4, In-State Gas Line Development Corp. Mr. Chairman, would you like me to pick up where we left off on that?
I believe so. We were on page, top of page 5 on the sectional, I believe.
We were talking about the validity of pledge. Is that to your recollection?
That's correct. That's on page 5 of the sectional, just about halfway down for the Secretary.
Very good. So again, this is Section 3 of House Bill 4. Section 3 is what creates AGDC's corporate identity and statute, including its powers and responsibilities and duties. Section 3.
For the record, Representative Wilson has joined us.
Thank you. Section 3 creates an entirely new chapter of state law to provide this corporate authority. And so Section 3125-180 within that new chapter of law is validity of pledge. And what this does is declares as valid and binding any pledge of assets or revenue that the corporation makes to payment or to interest. And again, this is, like many of these, a standard statement that lenders are going to need to see. And it assures those lenders that AGDC has, in fact, the statutory authority to pledge revenue for repayment of issuing revenue bonds. It has sort of a side track there, too, in that it protects AGDC's contract under the U.S. Constitution Contracts Clause so that future legislative action can't violate those protected contracts. Section 3125-190, Capital Reserve Funds, allows AGDC to establish capital reserve funds to secure its obligations and directs the fund management. We do require annual reports to the governor and the legislature in relation to these capital reserve funds. This section does create a moral but not a legal obligation of the state to replenish, if necessary, a reserve fund in which you've made withdrawals to cover interest payments due on bonds. Section 3125-200, Remedies, permits the enforcement of rights by those that hold AGDC obligations. This, again, is a very standard bond authority term that lenders want to see within your bonding statutory authority. Section 3125-210, Negotiable Instruments, is also a very standard statement that lenders need to see. This essentially says that obligations that AGDC makes are, in fact, promises to pay an amount of money.
And Ms. Delbert, let the record reflect that Representative Chenault has joined us as well.
Section 3125-220, Obligations Eligible for Investment, specifies that AGDC obligations or bonds are legitimate investments. What this does is provides that Alaska banks and others that have fiduciary duties to their investors can buy into these bonds. It's a certified investment, if you will. Section 3125-230, Refunding Obligations. This is what allows the corporation to refund obligations and provides direction for managing those refunds. You might have refunds if you, refinancing is a common thing with revenue bonds, with most bonds, I believe, and it's to be expected that when there's an opportunity to secure a better interest rate, they will refinance. Therefore, we need them to have the authority to refund their previous obligations as they take on those new ones. Mm-hmm. Section 3125-240.
Excuse me, Representative Seaton.
Yes, sir.
On the refunding of obligations, if there's a takeover of those obligations so that the money is refunded to AGDC, does that, if there's actual refund, does that money stay in AGDC or does that come back to the general fund if the general fund is advanced?
I believe that because AGDC is exempt under this legislation from the Executive Budget Act, that money does not necessarily come back to the general fund. I can get an absolute answer for you on that.
And Mr. Chairman, that'd be fine, but I would like that.
Absolutely.
And again, per usual, if you'd give that to the chair, we can distribute it out to everyone on the committee. Thanks.
Yes, sir. Section 3125-240, credit of the state not pledged, prohibits AGDC from pledging the state's faith and credit in issuing bonds. So anything that AGDC issues as an obligation is limited to AGDC's own backing. Section 3125-250, limitation on personal liability, protects the corporation's officers from personal liability in conjunction with their duties. There's an expectation that this is a provision that should be of value in trying to attract qualified board members. Section 3125-260, tax exemption, exempts AGDC from paying state and local property taxes, state and local taxes on the corporation's property or property income. Section 3125-270, annual report, requires an annual report to the governor, the legislature, and the public that needs to include an independently audited financial statement.
With your indulgence, Representative Seaton, Antar, and a little slower. Thanks.
Yes, sir.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. The tax exemption for property that the corporation owns, is there, if the AGDC becomes a partner in a property, is the property then tax exempt for, I know there was a provision that said that it was exempt until it went into commercial operation. The way I'm seeing this, it says that it's going to be exempt from all taxation for the life of the project, basically.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, there is a provision later in the bill that would exempt any AGDC partnership property, a pipeline that AGDC is involved with, regardless of who owns it, from paying state and local property taxes during construction. This now, within its corporate authority, any property that AGDC has is always exempt, but AGDC needs to be the owner of that property. It is fairly standard within the state that we don't have one state entity taxing another state entity, and that's why that's in this corporate provision.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
Following up, can you get back to us some legal analysis on that to say when that, what that extent would be? I mean, are we like the Ketchikan shipyard if we're a partner in that with ADA? Does that then become a non-taxable entity? I just want to make sure that, and I have no problem at all with having tax exemption during the construction, but this could be not only this particular pipeline, but could be in the future other, and putting one project, giving them a competitive advantage over another finance project, a project financed not by the state, would be kind of picking winners and losers in the commercial realm. And so I just want to make sure what the parameters of that is, so I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely. Representative Seaton, through the chair, we'd be happy to provide, I think you're looking for confirmation as to how this would play out.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Correct it, and the limitations on that as far as, partnership in it, does that mean that there's some ownership by ADGC in whatever project that would be? Would that then change the competitive status between a project that was financed by AGDC and a project that was financed independently, one pays taxes, the other doesn't pay taxes? That's what I think we wanted to find out. I think that's not the case, but I want to make sure.
Thank you.
Great. And to that point, actually, where was the, which section does the partnership in which AGDC partners are exempt, which provision, sorry, which section is that provision in?
The property tax exemption is in Section 34 of the bill.
Great.
And this, again, Section 34, property tax exemption, AGDC-owned or financed project from state and local property taxes during construction. And the sponsors included this provision in this legislation because this is one way that the state, having declared AGDC its designee to go out and do pipeline projects that are in the interest of the state, we can help that project succeed by keeping costs down and not taking taxes from it during that very critical period when risk is at an absolute high.
Thank you. For the record, Representatives Johnson and Tucker joined us. Representative Andy Johns-Josephson is in the audience, and Representative Tarr has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I was just trying to compare this section to Section 34 that you just mentioned. And in both cases, do we have an idea of what the lost revenue is for the state by allowing for that property tax exemption?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, I do believe that it is not. If I could, Frank Richards with AGDC is in the room. I would ask if they have perhaps run those calculations.
Mr. Richards, please come forward. And, of course, name for the record, et cetera, et cetera.
For the record, Frank Richards, Alaska Gasline Development Corporation, Engineering and Government Affairs Manager. Through the chair, Representative Tarr, I don't have those numbers right off the top of my head. I believe the taxation rate is about 20 mils, but we all calculate that and provide it back to the committee.
Thank you.
Thanks. That's correct. Okay, right. Other questions? Please proceed.
Okay. Moving on, Section 3125-270, annual report, again, requires an annual report to the governor and the legislature and the public. This is to include an independent audited financial statement. Hmm. Section 3125-390 are definitions. The definitions included in this legislation were in pieces brought over from the former 3834 statute, which was the statute that was created through the passage of House Bill 369. Okay. Section 4 of the bill, we're moving out of the corporate authority. Section 4 is a procurement code exemption. We talked about this briefly in our previous discussion of the corporate authority. We exempt it as a corporation, but then we need to go to the actual procurement code and put the exemption in there as well. So AGDC, its subsidiaries, and ANDA contracts would be exempt from the state procurement code.
My name is Chair.
Representative Tuck, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions on the procurement. I guess it goes back to also why put AGDC under Department of Commerce, Community Economic Development, rather than like the Department of Transportation, where we have a good solid procurement system already, and they do a lot with infrastructure, and I see this as kind of quite a piece of infrastructure. Now, I know that you were saying at one time that AEA did not have subsidiary powers, but does Department of Commerce, Community Economic Development have subsidiary powers?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, I'm not sure if the State Department has subsidiary powers or not. I would have to suggest that it probably does not, as it's a department and not a corporation. As to your first question as to why this was placed under Commerce, the sponsors believed that in-state gas line projects are about more than simply the project construction. It's about trying to put together the financial deal and the terms, trying to negotiate with a lot of diverse commercial entities. Pulling together the package is of great great importance, just as the actual construction process is. The Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, by mere nature of its name, fully represents, I think, the gains to the state and the benefits that the sponsors believe AGDC as a corporation will bring, both in commerce and also to our economic development through industry and large mines and smaller community projects. And also in developing our communities and giving them opportunities.
Okay, thank you. And one follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Two follow-up, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then you were going to come back to us and explain what is it about the state's procurement codes that don't work for a project like this.
Representative Tuck, through the chair, we absolutely were. We have a number of items that the committee asked about on our last hearing on Monday. We are developing answers to those questions. We do appreciate the chairman's patience in that. There are a few legal opinions that are required, conjunction with some AGIA questions and whatnot, that are taking a little bit longer than we would have liked.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your patience.
Thanks. appreciate you taking time to give us thorough answers. That's great.
So Section 5 of the bill is something that we have in here that corresponds to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska chapter that we have later on in the bill. So it's conforming. The RCA collects fees from the entities that it regulates under any of the regulatory frameworks that it has. And so those fees are intended to cover the RCA's costs and therefore are not accounted for within the general fund. This bill adds another kind of regulatory framework to the RCA's jurisdiction, and so we need to also exempt this new framework, Chapter 4208, we need to add that to the regulatory frameworks that the RCA can collect fees for and not have subject back into the general fund. Section 6, this is conforming to Section 10 that creates covenants that are specific to a contract carrier pipeline. I'm sorry, to Section 11. I apologize. We've created a second set of covenants reflecting contract carriage, so we have to go back to places in statute where it mentions the covenants that are in place for a common carrier and add in this option as well. So when something is subject to the covenants that exist in 120, we're now saying or in 121 as applicable.
Question, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify for me, it does say to conform with Section 10.
Yes, ma'am. Representative Wilson, through the chair, I see that I have made a typo in the sectional, and I apologize for that.
So it should read Section 12 there?
Or 11.
I'm sorry, 11.
11.
Okay.
Don't confuse it.
Don't confuse things. Okay.
Fortunately, Section 10 does also relate to that, but it's simply a conforming section. So.
Get back.
Thank you.
Okay.
That's it. Section 7, definitions. Repeals the definitions in the 3834 public land in-state natural gas pipeline section to refer to the new definitions in 3125. When House Bill 369 passed, 3834 was created. There were definitions put in that specific to this kind of a project and AGDC's work. Since we've created a new corporate structure in statute for AGDC, we have moved those definitions into that new corporate structure for AGDC. Section 8 deals with the right-of-way leases is conforming to those changes that we just talked about in Section 11. Section 9 and Section 10 are also conforming to the Section 11 changes that we make about the Right-of-Way Leasing Act. Section 11 is where we change the Right-of-Way Leasing Act. We establish covenants that are appropriate to a contract carrier gas pipeline. The section does not alter the existing covenants within the Right-of-Way Leasing Act for a common carrier pipeline. A carrier would go and apply to the state for a right-of-way lease either under the common carrier covenants or under the contract carrier covenants. And then, of course, there is a great deal of negotiating and application involved before the commissioner actually grants that right-of-way lease. These new covenants we discussed at some length during the PowerPoint presentation on Monday. I will briefly touch on what they do here. First of all, any pipeline that wants to apply as a contract carrier for a state right-of-way lease could apply under these covenants. We are not making it only specific to AGDC, no special treatment. They are very similar to the common carrier covenants. They require services from your pipeline be offered without unreasonable discrimination. You must obey the laws of the state. You must not abandon a pipeline until it's appropriate. You have to clean up after your damages if there are any. There are also some key differences. The common carrier covenants require expansions as deemed necessary by the RCA. The new contract covenants respect that under the regulatory framework, we have used the contracts between a shipper and a pipeline to set the terms for such things as expansions. And therefore, expansions are still required for a contract carrier, but when that carrier is presented with a commercially feasible opportunity to expand and not simply when told to do so by another body.
Sure. Question, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Making this change, we have a number of common carrier pipelines on the Kenai Peninsula. Can an application be made to change that from a common carrier pipeline to a contract carrier pipeline? I mean, a good example would be Armstrong's pipe. They had 2 4-inch pipelines, and Hillcorp has a pipeline that goes from their field out, which under the existing things are common carrier pipelines that then allow access for other gas to come into that if it's found. Could people use this authority to apply for those to become common carrier or contract carriage pipelines and then change the ability to for new operations to get gas into those existing lines?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I believe that that would largely be up to the Department of Natural Resources to govern how, in fact, they would manage applications to amend their existing right-of-way leases if, in fact, a leasee wanted to go through that process to essentially reapply or to amend their existing lease. It's a very, I think, long and complex process. Again, AGDC can provide that kind of testimony. It's not a simple thing to do that. Now, the DNR commissioner always retains the authority to decide whether or not an applicant should be issued a right-of-way lease under whatever set of covenants they apply under. Nothing mandates that a certain pipeline, you don't get to just pick what you are. The DNR commissioner, in issuing that lease, gets to decide whether or not you are, in fact, that kind of a pipeline.
And just follow on. But this authority may give the ability of those pipelines to reapply for existing pipelines and change gas pipelines from common carrier to contract carrier. Is that what I'm understanding? I'm just trying to.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I do understand what you're asking. I don't know what the existing DNR process is for amending a right-of-way lease, especially when the covenants are such a key piece of that lease. It's not a small modification.
Okay. And if we could find out.
If we could, if you can answer that, great. If not, we may need to bring in someone from DNR to ask those questions. Other questions?
Okay. Section 12 also deals with right-of-way leases and requires that a right-of-way lease be issued to AGDC at no cost. This reinforces the provisions that we have within AGDC's corporate statute that require interagency cooperation. Right now, AGDC is paying close to $200,000 a year for its right-of-way lease that it has through the state. And again, if the legislature, through House Bill 4, finds that AGDC is doing gas pipelines in the best interest of the state, it is perhaps, in the sponsor's viewpoint, not very productive to then have to pay a fee to a state agency as a lease payment.
And what's the current annual payment again, please?
I believe it's $180,000. If I can ask, okay, I'm correct.
Good enough.
Confirmation. Section 13 deals with judicial review. What Section 13 does is it limits the judicial review of state lease permit and other authorization decisions. Claims challenging the provision here in the bill that provides the limitations have to be brought within 60 days of the effective date of this legislation. Future claims on a decision that is made in the future need to allege a constitutional violation, and they need to be brought within 60 days of the action, and they need to be filed in Superior Court. The court may not grant injunctive relief that, as we discussed Monday, would halt the project while a court sorts out the complaint that's being made.
Question, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this particular section, I'm just not aware of whether we have the ability as the legislature to limit what the judicial branch would do in terms of timing, particularly on a constitutional issue. Is it clear, or is there someone from Department of Law that might be able to address that?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, we have not brought anyone with Department of Law with us today. I'm sure that the committee chairs can request their presence as needed. I appreciate your question. There are other instances where judicial review has been limited. Judicial review was limited for TAPs. It was also limited on federal decisions through the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act of 2004. The intent is that in those instances in which the state itself has sort of declared something, again, in the best interest of the public of the state, that it's reasonable to put some boundaries on the kinds of things that on the process of objecting to those things.
Okay. And if we need to, we can get someone from DOL in to answer those kind of questions and we'll get them together.
Thank you.
Are there other questions on that section?
Not seeing any, but...
Section 14, Personnel Act Exemption, exempts AGDC and its subsidiaries from the State Personnel Act exempt service. This exemption, again, is something that is also in AGDC's corporate statutes when we went through those. Mm-hmm. Section 15, Public Officials...
I'm sorry, excuse me, question, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe it's obvious, but what's the reason for doing that? Is that simply so you can pay people what they're worth or get outside the salary scales that the State Personnel Act requires?
Representative Feige, through the chair, that's largely the impact of that. Yes, absolutely. AGDC expects to need to be hiring a number of very expert people in very particular fields and on a competitive level with the private sector entities that they're going to be working with to put this mm-hmm. pipeline together.
Okay, thank you.
Section 15 makes the Board of Directors of AGDC and any of its subsidiaries subject to the public official financial disclosure rules that are in the State Personnel Act. Oddly enough, this is one where you have to make people specifically subject to it.
Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the club.
Representative Seaton.
The combination of these two, the Personnel Act exemption, I understand, are members of the Board of Directors considered employees or and exempt from that as well? I don't want to get into the situation where we've had some corporations that have raised the salaries quite a bit. And so, Board of Directors versus employees, or are they the same?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the Board of Directors is specifically not to be employees of the corporation. And so the Board of Directors are not employees. They receive a compensation per day on official board business, and they receive per diem and travel when they need to come to board meetings and whatnot. But they're not salaried.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Mr. Overage, I've got a question for you. This provision... This seems to be one of the few sections that actually does restate that there's a number of places where expediency and the importance of the project have motivated some exemptions and some streamlining limitations. This seems to be kind of contrary to that stream of postures. What's the reason for that?
Mr. Chairman, the public officials' disclosures?
Yes, yeah.
The sponsors have tried very hard to do that balancing act of being very responsible to Alaskans, because really this is about getting Alaskans and Alaskan gas connected. And at the same time trying to do exactly what you said and look to how we can provide for expediency and take out roadblocks that this entity is going to face going forward. One of the things that they believe Alaskans need to know is if in fact there are any financial interests by the board members that would potentially cause a conflict. That's just open and fair disclosure.
That's good. I agree in that kind of public disclosure. I do know that the expansion of public disclosures to other boards and commissions service has tended to inhibit people from serving and to limit the pool of qualified applicants. So I caution you about that.
Thank you. We appreciate that.
Other questions, Representative Tarr?
On that point, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there an instance where you could see a conflict of interest resulting in a board member being dismissed, or who would have the authority to assess that?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, the governor appoints the members of this board, and they serve, they can be removed for cause by the governor. Part of the reason for the public officials' financial disclosure is that it's a small state, and we've all seen where there is something that could be a conflict of interest, but once disclosed publicly mm-hmm. and made aware, there's less of an opportunity for it to pose a genuine conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And along those lines, actually a question, you know, of course, legislature, we had the ability to declare conflict and request to not vote. Is there any such provision to allow board members of AGDC to try and exempt themselves from taking a vote if there is a conflict?
Mr. Chairman, no, there is not.
Okay. Would that cause any problems in the kind of supermajority or super quorum? I'm sorry, the voting major decisions have to have, is it four votes, five votes?
Mr. Chairman, they need to have a majority of the board as an affirmative vote. So it would need to be three members of the board voting in favor of something substantive in order for that to pass.
Okay. I have to war game that to see how that would work out. But Representative Johnson, question?
Holding up three.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, you raise a good point, and I'm sure that the sponsors would love to try and find a way to address that.
Any other questions on these points? Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Section 16 deals with confidentiality. Under Section 16, certain eligible information and information covered by confidentiality agreements that AGDC has with other entities are not eligible for disclosure under the State Public Records Act. In Section 3, we talked at length about what kinds of things can, in fact, be kept confidential and how confidentiality agreements with private sector entities and other state entities to protect third parties would work. This is sort of that backstop that says those things allowed to be held confidential don't get to be released under the State Public Records Act.
Representative Seaton, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think we broached this earlier, but I wanted to, in previous discussions, but under confidentiality, the question of the duration of the confidentiality, there's things that need to be confidential for till a contract is signed. There are things that need to be done until a project is complete, but at which time they don't need to be confidential anymore. And so I would really appreciate it if you, working with AGDC, would line out what items need to be held confidential for forever. And which things actually give the public more confidence in the project, knowing that in the end the bids, they're going to be able to see did the low bid get taken or not, because the bids would be available, and those other data that are no longer necessary to be held confidential. I think that gives the public much more confidence that going forward they are going to be able to see that data when it's no longer necessary to be confidential. So I'd request that, you know, as the bill goes forward, you come back to us and see if there's a way that we can line out those things that do and don't need to be confidential. I think that gives the public a lot more confidence.
Sure. Representative Seaton, through the chair, is that something that you'd like to go over now, what's held confidential and what kind of time limits we would expect on that confidentiality, or is that something where you'd like to see a kind of a written comparison of different items to be held confidential?
Mr. Chairman, personally what I'd like to do is just have you get together with probably Mr. Fauske and Mr. Richards and others and figure out what that would be, and we could just have a little spreadsheet showing what, and so it would be helpful to do it that way instead of just verbally now.
Yeah. I think there's going to be a number of questions or areas, general areas to explore in detail, so I want to give you the opportunity to get through the sectional in the time we have available. That's a good point. There's one of the many issues to talk about. So.
We'd be happy to. Thank you.
Representative Feige's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And kind of along the lines of Representative Seaton's point about timelines and time limits on confidentiality, is there anything in this that that limits what can be held confidential versus not confidential? And are there any limits on, I mean, can AGDC make everything, all their business, confidential, or is it limited to certain particular items? And if you could include that in the spreadsheet, I think that'd work out just fine.
Absolutely. Representative Feige, through the chair, there are some limits that reflect commercial harm and whatnot. I'm happy to make sure that that is clearly articulated in a document.
Okay, thanks.
Great. All right, proceed.
Okay. Section 17 of the bill and the next several sections relate to the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority, or ANGDA. Overall, what this legislation does is transforms ANGDA's purpose from that as a gas pipeline builder to that of a gas pipeline marketer or aggregator, a middleman, if you will, that can ship gas for other parties. In doing so, this bill also transitions ANGDA into a subsidiary corporation of AGDC. Section 17 in particular then amends ANGDA statutes to retain ANGDA's purpose of acquiring natural gas produced in the state and delivering it to markets in insufficient quantity to help assure that long-term viability of a pipeline project, but it removes those other purposes such as designing, constructing, operating, and maintaining a pipeline and other facilities. Those abilities and missions have been given to AGDC.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just curious that I think ANGDA had been a bidder on firm transportation for some other entities, utilities. What would be, if this is enacted, the status of those bids, or are those, do those go to some other entity or what?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, are you referring to the bids in the Alaska Pipeline Project that TransCanada held an open season for?
I believe that was, there have been too many pipeline projects. It was either that or the small diameter one earlier that there were, but I can't remember which one.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I do believe that ANGDA did put some bids on an in-state gas arm of that large pipeline that TransCanada put to an open season. However, TransCanada has closed its open season and moved on to another project. And so my understanding from the Department of Law is that there would be no continuing, from the Department of Revenue, there are no ongoing debts or liabilities associated with ANGDA.
And just to clarify, ANGDA would be a subsidiary, would not be the only subsidiary AGDC would be allowed to have.
You are correct, Mr. Chairman.
And it would not even limit ANGDA to being the only gas marketer subsidiary.
You are correct.
Not that would see a need, but okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Section 18 is what actually makes ANGDA a subsidiary of AGDC. ANGDA is currently situated in the Department of Revenue. Section 19 amends, again, ANGDA statutes to clarify that role of a gas marketer. Section 20 deals with the ANGDA board and makes AGDC's board of directors the board of ANGDA. Section 21, ANGDA board compensation reflects that AGDC's board members, when serving as ANGDA's board, are entitled to compensation as they would receive as AGDC's board.
Question, Representative Wilson, question.
Thank you. So ANGDA's board is going to be the same board as the other one?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, yes, ma'am, it would be the same board as I believe relatively common with subsidiary corporations.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess it goes back to Representative Johnson's question. Why? Why? I mean, if it's all the same, why have the subsidiary? Why have that extra layer? Why have that middleman, as you pointed out earlier?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, a middleman is important. A marketing entity is important, or could be very important in this pipeline. There is a chance that we have a number of smaller entities, including maybe electric utilities in the state, that may not have the creditworthiness or the backing financially to commit to long-term shipments on this pipeline on their own. And therefore, having some sort of a middleman or a marketer to make those long-term commitments and ship the gas for them can be very important in getting those folks their gas. I believe Representative Johnson's question of the other day was, if we don't need this subsidiary to be ANGDA, then why have we enabled that to happen? Is that what you were additionally following up on?
No, if I may, Mr. Chair. Okay. It's basically, why not just make that a function of AGDC as a whole? I mean, it's all, why separate it?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, and it's necessary to have some level of a firewall between the actual pipeline company that's offering space for shipment, space for sale, and the folks that are buying space, whether that's a market or an individual. And so there needs to be a firewall between those entities. It's a little bit, if I could use an analogy, like ExxonMobil Production Company and ExxonMobil Pipeline Company. It's the same corporate entity, but there are specific firewalls in between the parent and its subsidiary.
And if I may, one follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Tuck.
And I understand why Exxon would want to do that for liabilities and so forth. Is that what the concern here is liabilities, or is it, I mean, it's all one entity, same board. If you can get back to us and let us know the purpose of that firewall, not that it needs to be there, but why it needs to be there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. That would probably be a good question for the attorneys to answer for us. Representative Seaton, question?
Thank you. And I was just wondering whether, was that the conflict of interest problem that we had previously when we were looking at building a pipeline, regulating it, and also being a shipper? And so you were sitting on both sides of the table at one time as a legal entity. Those needed to be separate for the conflict of interest requirements.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I believe that is one reason that you would want to separate these kinds of things. Certainly, your private sector partners are going to like knowing that all of their shippers are getting a fair deal and getting fair negotiations that are made, if you will, at arm's length, and that there's not a special deal being cut for a marketer. A marketer may not specifically ship just the state's utility gas, for example. It could be going to a private sector company that wants gas also. So it is a matter of keeping things very fair and very clear.
Yeah.
Representative.
One more. And that is, since it's a subsidiary of AGDC, would you also follow up when we're talking about tax consequences or tax non-liabilities for taxes, if there's anything in here that would then put ANGA in a different tax situation than another shipper, so that we would be setting up a duality of competition and unfair and advantaging ANGA through some tax consequence that another private party shipper would not receive the benefit of. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I might be repeating a little bit what you just said because I was thinking about this when he was finishing up, so it might be repetitive here. But actually what this is just insulating AGDC from recourse because it will stop at ANGA.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
Okay. I'm trying to figure out in my own head why they're needed, because they're the same people. And is it just because it just puts it, they're an insulator, you call it a firewall, that if there's negotiations or something going on and somebody wants to sue or something like that they would have to stop at that entity rather than go to the whole company? I'm trying to figure out why.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I may have steered the committee down a difficult course when I said that it's the same. The board of directors would be the same, but the firewall exists so that the two corporations are distinct and are not supposed to be talking to each other as they make a deal, as if they were not attached. And as far as the specific legal recourse from a subsidiary to its parent corporation, we're happy to get back to you on that, or I believe Dan Fauske with AHFC and AGDC is here in the room and could probably talk quite well to that.
Would Mr. Fauske like to address that question? Again, knowing it might be a legal question, have to go to council for, but at least let you take a swing at it.
Good afternoon. My name is Dan Fauske. I'm CEO of Alaska Housing and president of AGDC. And could I please hear the question again to make sure? I want to make sure I understand.
Well, thank you. Actually, what I'm doing is trying to understand it, so I'm not sure how to ask the question, really. But so ANGA is going to have its own people working in it, but the same board of directors. And AGDC is going to have its own people working on it, but they're both going to have the same board of directors. And she said that that gave a put a firewall in between you guys so that, and I'm just trying to see a simple way in my mind to say that that's okay, to understand why that has to be and why it can't just you guys do it.
Representative Wilson, through the chair. Currently at Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, the board of directors is also the board of directors for the Northern Tobacco Securitization Corporation, the Alaska Capital Management Corporation, the Alaska Corporation for Affordable Housing. Those are the four I can remember right now. Same board, same staff, same everything. What Rena had referred to earlier is that the board would have to be very careful as it conducted its business with the individual corporations. The federal government, under FERC guidelines and others, are very strict in reference to a pipeline company and a shipping company, that there has to be a clear firewall, that there cannot be an association where the two are doing business as one. You can have a board that oversees it, but have a separate board meeting and conduct the business of that organization separately. That is absolutely possible, but there are very strict guidelines as to how that business activity occurs. What could essentially happen is the same people that are running AGDC, for instance, building the pipeline, are sitting in a room with the same people that are going to ship it with no public input, no oversight, if you will, in conducting business in that way. That is something that the federal government and others through the pipeline acts and others would strictly prohibit. But there are ways to do it that are actually quite efficient. For instance, Alaska Housing Board, we just had the annual Northern Tobacco Securitization Board meeting the other day. They call themselves to order, do the minutes, they adjourn, and then they come back in and they call themselves back in as the Northern Tobacco Securitization Corporation and conduct a separate meeting. Does that help?
Yes. So in other words, it's just a way of getting around the rules and regulations so that you can do it the way they say you have to do it.
Well, Representative Wilson, now, in this case, if this bill proceeds as it is written with the creation of this authority, and you're going to take great care as to who you pick as those board members are going to be equally have the equal ability to serve not only on the AGDC board for the pipeline activities, but certainly the gas marketing, because the way that the job descriptions and or requirements are being looked at is you're going to try and get people that are in that industry. So the idea of the same board handling similar business is very
common.
Very common.
Okay. Thank you.
I think what might help you, Representative Wilson, is the day-to-day operations of the separate entities have to be very clearly delineated. We even at Alaska Housing, the bonds of the Northern Tobacco Securitization Corporation are not a liability of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, even though it is a subsidiary of Alaska Housing. It was structured that way so that when we sold the bonds, there was a premium paid because the tobacco bonds were a risky business anyway, and the state of Alaska did very well on those. But we were very clear that they couldn't pierce the corporate veil if the bonds failed and then come in and start attacking the assets of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And so that's a very good example, I think, that shows legally how you structure yourself without creating dozens of boards and having this huge bureaucracy, if you will, and yet be open to the public, effective, and diligent in your deliberations.
Okay, thank you.
We have Tar, and then Seaton, and Doc.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to ask about that point. So would that be true of this separation in terms of the liability? Some financial obligation through HANGDA not be met, then it would only affect the subsidiary corporation, but would not then have a financial impact on the parent corporation?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, it depends. That's the way I would advise that you would set something up. You'd have to see the individual transaction, but yes, you would very carefully structure it so that those activities, for instance, in the program that we've described over the last few years, if the AGDC were involved in the issuance of the debt on behalf of this gas pipeline, that would be a solely owned debt of that corporation, not a debt of the state of Alaska, not a debt of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, not a debt of ANGDA if ANGDA were rolled into it. It would be a wholly owned subsidiary, separate and clear from other activities. Okay. The thing to remember on that, Representative, which I think people find helpful, is the investors are made very well aware of that at the time that the preliminary OS is what it's called, the POS goes out, and you start receiving inquiries and bids, if you will, or when you finally do go to close the deal, the final offers from investors as to what they would pay for those particular documents. But the clarity and the amount of information that you have to supply is immense. It is such full disclosure, so that no one can come back on you later and say, well, you didn't tell us that. Mm-hmm. We are very clear that you, and the lawyers go through it, and we all go through it. So the deals would be structured so that they're separate entities. Now, there could be an opportunity where, smaller transaction and mutually beneficial to both organizations, but I'd have to see it to, we'd have to take a look at something. I can't think of one now, mm-hmm. Representative, clearly that would come to mind. Okay.
Just a quick follow-up.
Follow-up on that?
And so then when you talk about AHFC, certainly makes, very large capital expenditures. The subsidiary corporations, I know through the tobacco one, that is going to eventually go away as we get through our payments from that, right? The other two, can you compare the relative size and scale of financial obligation that the other two or three that you mentioned are making in comparison to the relationship of this one? These would be making enormous capital expenditures. Is that sort of the same model, or are they operating with smaller sums of money?
They, Representative Tatar, they meaning AGDC or ANGDA or?
AHFC, when you talked about the other subsidiaries, are we talking about the same scale in terms of financial obligations being made through those separate corporations?
Representative, no. For instance, on an annual basis, I come before the legislature, or a report does, it says, I would like this year, we anticipate that we're going to do $800 million mm-hmm. in bonding activity, and the legislature, through its bills, passes and says, yes, they have the authority to go that far. There's no further dealings with the legislature in regards to that transaction. If I need to come back and we need to exceed that amount, then I would have to come back and legislative approval. So in that regard, there's a checks and balances on the amount of debt. And the thing to also remember is that you're really dealing, AHFC has its own general obligation credit, which we use on a limited basis, but it's unique in America that a Housing Finance Corp. And we use it sparingly, and we use it very judiciously. It's a tax-exempt status that has benefited the people of the state very well. The majority of the work that you do are tax revenue anticipation notes, revenue bonds, mortgage revenue bonds. That the full faith and credit of the deal is based on the security of the economy in the state, the credit scores on the borrowers, and all the things that go into analyzing where the money comes to pay those bonds. And in a mortgage revenue bond, it is the creditworthiness of the people that are paying off their mortgages. Because what we do in the secondary market is we go to the market and we sell bonds, we take that cash, and then banks and others submit, and we purchase the mortgages from banks. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, AGDC would have, if you are involved in the financing of a $7.5 to $8 billion project, mm-hmm. I'm glad you asked that question because this gives me an opportunity, if I may indulge the committee.
Really?
This too is a revenue bond, mm-hmm. and it is not based on the full faith and credit of the state of Alaska, nor is it based on the full faith and credit of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. It will be a standalone deal. And the way that is then structured as you must go before the investors, you must go before the rating agencies, you have a whole series of checks and balances that you go through, because what you are doing is you're selling a product. And that product has to be creditworthy, and it has to be noteworthy in the sense that there's lots of products for sale on the street, and the investor has many, many choices as to what they want to purchase. So the due diligence and the scrutiny that is applied is severe. For instance, the revenue bonds that could be sold by AGDC, hundreds of millions of dollars worth, could be purchased by pension funds, insurance companies, municipalities, and others that actively pursue. And the Alaska Permanent Fund would be an example of where they go out and buy institutional investments. Mm-hmm. The bonds, as I've testified in the past, would be about the last transaction you would make. Mm-hmm. Before you could ever go to Wall Street and initiate a deal, you're going to have all the firm transportation and all the precedent agreements. Everything's going to have to be in place, because it's the investor that has to see a clear path between his investment and the project that he's investing in. Mm-hmm. And so the bond deal then becomes the final straw, if you will, to culminate, the deal, because all those contracts are in place, and hopefully the longer the contracts you can get, the better that it works. But many times, these contracts are 10, 15, 20-year contracts. And I've talked about this before on common versus contract carrier, and I don't want to, but that ties back into that, because if it's a difference in the transaction. And so then you'd sell the bonds, and then the cash would come in to help pay off the project. And you'd structure it. It'd be very complex structuring, but we do it all the time in terms of you might have five-year serials and term bonds going out 10 years and all these things that you do to maximize the benefit to the project and to the people of the state. I hope I didn't get too long-winded.
No,
I hope
that helped.
It's educational.
No.
Actually, a procedural note for the folks in the audience and the witnesses. Our intent is to continue probably until about 2:30 or so. We do have folks who are here to testify on HB 77. So far, only a few. So if you do want to testify on that bill, please go sign up on the outside sheet. And based upon how many people we have on the list, that's how much time we'll leave. So we do want to let the sponsors' staff give as much time as we can. Got questions from Representative Seaton, Tuck, and Johnson. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. One real quickie and then another. On Section 21, I just want the next one will be. On Section 21, just to clarify the way it says in the sectional here that they'll get $400 a day compensation. But those aren't concurrent, right? So if the board meets on today on one and then they adjourn and go into the other, they're not getting two compensations of the same. It's just if they meet at one time or another. Is that correct? I just want to clarify for the public.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I'm actually glad that Mr. Fauske is still right here. how exactly does that work for AHSC?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I have to think about this for a minute, because it can occur where the board meeting occurs on the same day, but it's the activities of two separate boards. Well, I know through the years we've tried to get the HFC board stipend increased. They're still paid $100 for a meeting. It hasn't changed since 1972. I know for the Northern Tobacco, when we wrote that bill, that the board members were paid, and we used the permanent fund as an example as to how to attract board members to serve on a board. So there's a difference in pay for the two different boards. They're different. It is possible that they could draw pay for each board meeting during the day. And I want to do some research on that to make sure I understand your question clearly, and I want to make sure that I don't misspeak on that one.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just bringing it up so it can be clarified, because the way it's written here, I'm sure we'll get comments from the public, and wanted to give you the opportunity to clarify however that'll be.
Thank you for that, Representative Seaton, through the chair. And the sponsor's intent is that if you have to be prepared and invest the time for any board meeting, even if they are in concurrent days, that you're compensated as that board member for that official business.
Okay. And the question I had was on ANGA, it was that the electric utilities might need someone that is more stable, has more assets to be able to market, to put together deals and secure that deal. But as I'm understanding, ANGA is not going to be tying in the assets of AGDC. So I am unclear how ANGA is going to bring assets to the table to secure this gas marketing deal if they aren't pledging AGDC's bonding or the assets of AGDC. And if you can answer that now, that's fine. If you want to get back to us later this month.
Can you answer how a marketing subsidiary would actually put
them
together?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, it goes back to a little bit what I said earlier, that ANGA would be a marketing arm of the corporation that is separate and apart from. They would be the entity that would go out and actually sit down and negotiate the price on the gas and market the gas. AGDC in this context is a pipeline company. So ANGA would be their marketing arm that would serve as negotiator to sit down with other utilities and others to market the gas.
And for the record, that was Dan Fauske. That's good. Briefly.
And briefly, I understand that, but the statement was that ANGA had value because it would be bringing security assets, I believe, is what we were talking about. And maybe that was a misunderstanding that there was something pledged, and maybe it was just the marketing ability. I just want to get it clear on the record.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, Dan Fauske again. One of the advantages we saw when we first had this discussion a year or so ago was the fact that the enabling legislation that created ANGDA was already in place. So why reinvent the wheel? And just utilize those statutes, also honoring the fact that and many people had stated that the voters had voted to create it, so to try and continue on and utilize those tools to the benefit of the state was one of the primary drivers behind the utilization of existing statutes. I know that the bill removes the authority to issue debt and some of the other stuff. It doesn't. Okay.
All righty. Thank you. Obviously, a point of some interest. If you remember your questions, Representative Tuck, then Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I just want to keep this simple if possible, but if I know we've been talking a lot about this, but if you can just give us a fact sheet, a list, or a write-up of the pros and cons of having the subsidiary, you know, because you mentioned FERC, you mentioned taxes, risk, you mentioned bonding. If you don't mind, just because I know one entity has many reasons why to subsidize that may not be the same reasons for the other entity, but if you can keep it specific to this right here of why we need to do it in this particular project in this bill.
You're saying that the advantages of the overlapping boards, or what was it exactly?
The subsidiary, having the ANGDA subsidiary.
Representative Tuck, as the chair, if I could just clarify, any marketing subsidiary or ANGDA specifically?
The title really doesn't matter to me. I think that okay. is irrelevant. I think it's okay. More about why we need to have a marketing.
Sure.
Because you mentioned buying and selling, and that to me is different from marketing. So I'm getting terms confused. I really don't understand the intent, and I would like to have a better understanding.
We would be happy to comply with that.
I think that would be beneficial to have you or our lawyer answer those questions. All right, see no further questions. Please proceed. Ms. Delbridge. But I want to hang out.
Section 22 amends ANGDA to include legal and bond counsel in the services for which ANGDA may contract and exempting contracted services from the state procurement code. Section 23 amends ANGDA's statute requiring disclosure of conflicts of interest to remove the term a project from the circumstances requiring disclosure, as ANGDA is no longer statutorily enabled to do any projects.
Ms. Delbridge, I'm going to ask you, in between your citations of sections, take a breath, and it might just give us a chance to ask a question, because
sure.
I'm thinking on section 22, might ask you to add that same kind of question if the authorization for ANGDA itself to have its own bond counsel and legal counsel, you might add that same question, why is it necessary for them to have that independently? I think there's a great curiosity on the committee's membership to figure out why the need for the differentiation, what advantages and disadvantages, so that please add that to the list of those kinds of questions.
Absolutely.
Thank you. And then,
any questions on disclosure?
Seeing none, great.
I have a question.
Great, okay. Representative Wilson, question.
Not on disclosure, but on back up to Section 22, because there's a, it says with the repeal of this, it makes the Attorney General the legal counsel for ANGDA, and this section enables ANGDA, am I saying that right?
ANGDA?
ANGDA. To contract for legal and bond services. So is it taking away the Attorney General as a legal counsel or giving them?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, in the repealer section of House Bill 4, we repeal the section of ANGDA statute that makes the Attorney General legal counsel for ANGDA, and therefore, so that ANGDA can still have some direction, statutory direction, we say that they can go out and contract for legal counsel, which formerly they didn't need the ability to do, because formerly the Attorney General was to be their legal counsel.
Okay. So they don't have the Attorney General there now, so they've got to contract out for somebody else.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
And Section 23, then, disclosure of conflicts of interest with ANGDA's board related to projects. Do we have any questions, Mr. Chairman?
I don't see any.
Okay. Section 24 relates to ANGDA and confidentiality. ANGDA already has the ability to keep confidential some items. We're expanding that so that INGA and AGDC can make a confidential agreement together to share information.
Is there a question?
If I could.
Representative Johnson.
It's not a very effective firewall.
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I would suppose that that could pose some firewall problems.
That's all. No,
we would be happy to clarify in conjunction with the discussion as to why a marketing subsidiary is required and why there should be a firewall in place to include how the exchange of confidential information through CAs would impact that.
Okay.
Thank you. Section 25, INGA is a gas marketer. This removes INGDA's authority to exercise eminent domain, which INGDA does already have, as INGDA would no longer be a pipeline builder but a marketing arm. Section 26 deals with INGDA property. You'll see a little bit later in the bill, we have deleted the definition of project from INGDA's statutes, as INGDA is no longer to be doing projects. Therefore, we're making this conforming change. Previously, INGDA was allowed to have property and manage property for a project. But since we're getting rid of the ability to do project in the definition, we have to go back and say that their ability to have property and manage property is for purposes of the corporation.
And in this case, the corporation meaning INGDA or meaning AGDC?
INGDA. These are all within 4141, which would be INGDA's statute okay, district.
Okay. Question, Representative Wilson, then Seaton.
What kind of property would they have to, would they even be for the corporation's purpose, but not for a project? Give me for instance.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the difference would be, you know, a corporation might have property if it's doing a project that would be very tangible property that a project is on or that a project exists, a pipe. A corporation could have other property, too, that's not physical property, land or pipeline, but other assets, information, financial property.
Financial property.
What's financial property? What is financial property? That's it. Money.
Financial property. I would consider money, investments, accounts, debts, liabilities,
bonds.
You know, INGDA does, in fact. INGDA at one point had a conditional EIS for some right-of-way. That would be property of the corporation. What the sponsor's intent was, Representative Wilson, was that even if INGDA was no longer to be doing projects, it still is a corporation as a subsidiary of AGDC, and like most other state corporations, needs the ability to have property and then to manage it.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Representative Seaton, question?
Thank you. And it was on those same lines, but does that also include gas? I mean, with this property, do they have the ability to actually buy gas? And does that then, or is that excluded because we would have this conflict of interest of owning gas and shipping?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, INGDA as a marketing subsidiary would actually be paying the pipeline, AGDC, a fee to ship gas on the pipeline, and therefore INGDA absolutely could own gas. That it is then contracting with AGDC for shipment of.
More questions, Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm a little uncomfortable with going from a marketer to an owner of gas, and maybe you can give us a little discussion paper on with the difference between AGDC as an owner and a shipper of gas instead of as a marketer of gas, because it seems like it's outside of what the discussions of what the purpose of INGDA was going to be, and I just want to make sure that we're still online.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, we'd be happy to do that. Marketer, actually can be a difficult term in this context. Sometimes we think of a marketer as one that is to go out and to promote something, and that is not the context that we're trying to use marketer in this place. It's one to actually take a commodity and then market it, to get it from sellers to buyers. If that means owning it in the middle, that is absolutely the intent of the middleman concept, the aggregator. We will be happy to provide a paper outlining specifically what we're looking at that way.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And for the committee's benefit, there's about two more sections on ANGDA, so if you want to kind of jump through those, I think we're going to put some of these questions aside and give you a chance to get in the RCA section. And again, our intent is to stop this maybe at 2:45-ish to let those people here to testify next bill get the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 27 is, again, conforming because we deleted the definition of project from ANGDA statutes. References to a project in ANGDA's PLA, Project Labor Agreement statute, are now changed to mean that they must have PLAs for the purpose of the corporation and not PLAs for the purpose of the project. I'm sorry, not for the purpose of, but to secure timely completion of. Section 28, ANGDA definitions. This changes the definition of board within ANGDA statutes to mean the AGDC board acting as ANGDA's board.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back on your section analysis, I'm making sure I'm reading this correct. On section 27, the last sentence, with this change, ANGDA shall have project labor agreements that secure timely completion of a project or the corporation. Are you sure you meant ANGDA or do you mean AGDC?
A representative tech to the chair, ANGDA.
Okay, my understanding, if I may, Mr. Chair, is that they're not going to be able to do projects. I thought we just eliminated projects from their capabilities. So what is this exactly doing, if you don't mind?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, that was a question that I needed to ask to our ledge legal drafters as well. And the word project was in that section. And when we deleted the definition of the term project in another section of ANGDA statutes, we had to go back and take the term project out of this section as well.
Is it corporate purposes labor agreement instead? Don't respond to this, sir.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, you mentioned one section. I'm talking about the last term. You mentioned project as in project labor agreements. I'm talking about project as in secured timely completion of a project of the corporation, which has been identified as ANGDA, not AGDC. So if you can get the clarification on that. And it looks like to me, I mean, I know the intent is try to keep the ANGDA wishes of the public, but it looks like through these sections, you know, 19 all the way down to 28, and maybe even earlier, it's kind of stripping ANGDA of what it once was. And so I just want to make that as a comment, because if all we're going to have is by title, you know, it goes back to, I guess, Representative Johnson's question is why.
Representative Tuck, through the chair, duly noted the sponsor's intent was not to strip ANGDA. The sponsor's intent was to try and find a continuing role for ANGDA in a gas line project that is going forward, even though ANGDA no longer has offices, personnel, board members, or funding. Their intention was to then find a role for ANGDA within a broader project and not to simply strip it.
My original question stands.
And for the record, that was. Representative Johnson, do you want to restate that for the Secretary's benefit?
No, my original question stands. Why? I haven't seen a good reason yet.
Fair enough.
Unless it's a name on a door. I mean, that's the only thing I can see.
Representative Johnson, through the chair, there is no need. AGDC has the ability to create other subsidiaries for whatever purposes AGDC needs to create subsidiaries for to carry out its corporate mission. The sponsors recognize that ANGDA was voter created, and that makes it, I believe, politically difficult to eliminate. However, ANGDA had a very specific mission given to it by the voters to have a pipeline operational by 2007. A legislative audit in 2010 recommended that the legislature sunset ANGDA as it had exceeded, likely, its statutory authority in pursuing some of the other projects that it pursued after it was no longer able to deliver on its initial mission. It's been a balancing act for the sponsors in how to manage that.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What year was that audit, and when we can find it online? But if you can just give me a year, it'll help me.
Representative Johnson, through the chair, the audit was in 2010, the audit released, and I'd be happy to email your office a copy of that.
That would be, save my staff work.
They would also choose after this hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I would observe that, well, success has many fathers, and the fact that we're here talking about HB 4 today is some indication of the success of Engdon bringing this issue forward, so we want to give them due respect.
Absolutely.
And please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have moved out of the ANGDA sections.
Yay.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. The next several sections relate to regulation by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
Ms. Dobridge, let me ask you, pardon me for interrupting. Yes, again, we have other testimony. Would this be a good breaking point for you, or is there progress we could make in the RCA section, or would this be a good breaking point for you?
Mr. Chairman, in light of the committee's other items on the agenda today, if you would like, we can move through the next sections in a relatively easy way with the understanding that one of these sections creates an entirely new chapter of state law that we will go into, I know, at incredibly great detail at a later time.
You know, looking ahead, I think at this point, I think we're going to break away from this bill and go to 77, if you don't mind. I'm sure there will be lots of good questions. We want to be able to start fresh, answer some of these before we engage in new sections. So that will take a brief at ease to turn the room and get the HB 77.
Time we'll call this meeting of the House Resources Committee together. We are going to start taking public testimony on House Bill 77. It's a governor's bill relating to permitting. So my plan here is I'm going to let the folks in the room, which we have four currently in the room, they will testify first, and then we have two folks online in Anchorage, and I guess we're expecting some additional folks online. So without further ado, and I will ask testifiers to please keep their, given the number of folks and the time we have here, please keep your comments to about four or five minutes, no more. Laura Statz.
My name is Laura Statz. I live at 418 7th Street here in Juneau, Alaska. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. I am here to speak against the passage of House Bill 77. I come to you on behalf of myself, my family, and all the people who hunt and fish and gather food from this great land that we call Alaska. Most importantly, I come on behalf of my grandson, who is 4 years old, and who at this tender age has already gone out with his parents and his uncles and his grandparents to harvest salmon taller than he is and prawns bigger than his own hands. For him, there is a magic in that. And in that magic lies an honest reality which must be protected in perpetuity. And you have the responsibility to protect our lands, streams, and oceans. Please look to our Alaska Constitution when making your decision on voting for House Bill 77. It states in Article 8, Section 3, quote, common use, whenever occurring in their natural state, fish, wildlife, and waters are reserved to the people for common use, end quote. It explains in the Citizen Guide of the Alaska Constitution that, quote, this section enshrines in the Alaska Constitution the common law doctrine that natural resources must be managed by the state as a public trust for the benefit of the people as a whole, rather than for the benefit of the government, corporations, or private persons, end quote. Who will HB 77 be protecting and representing? Will it be protecting the common use clause of our Constitution and the rights of the citizens of Alaska? Or does it protect a corporation which has its own special interest, not consistent with that of preserving the tender balance of the streams and waterways where our food arises from? Please vote against passage of this bill. Thank you for hearing me.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Stats. Any questions from the committee for Ms. Stats? Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Next up, James Sullivan.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is James Sullivan, and I'm a legislative organizer for SEAC, the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify. I wanted to talk just about one specific issue. There's been a great deal of discussion within this committee and then within our own organization and with many of our friends about the issue of water reservations and the revoking of the personal use reservations. We find this issue to be problematic, and we want to make sure that our environment is being protected and that anadromous streams have the highest priority when permits are being issued. We'd like to propose that amendment be put in place here so that the bill, when any entity applies for a water right on any anadromous body of water, that DNR issue a water reservation on behalf of the fish. DNR can simply refer to the anadromous waters catalog already put in place by ADF&G to see if the waterway is on there, and if it is, then just put in an appropriate reservation. I think this would help align DNR with our state constitution and its public trust responsibility. It would ensure protection for our salmon, and it would enhance the sustainable economic development across our state. Salmon, as you know, Mr. Chairman, is our greatest renewable resource, and I think it's in our legislature's best interest to put a mechanism in statute that protects the resource as other entities apply for water rights. And that's it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Questions? Don't go anywhere just yet.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton?
Mr. Chairman, I was wondering if we could ask the people that testify if they have their written comments, if they could submit those. It's kind of hard to follow them all through. So,
and duly noted, if you do have written comments, we'd appreciate you leaving them with Mr. Fulton over here.
Any
questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, on a slightly different portion than you testified to on Section 1, where we're talking about the issuance of a general permit, the wording is the issuance of a general permit if the commissioner finds the activity is unlikely to result in significant and irreparable harm to the state land or resources. Has your organization looked at that, and do you find it problematic that you have to find that you're going to have irreparable harm before a general permit is issued, or instead of just significant harm, or have you discussed that at all?
To the chair, we have discussed that issue about irreparable harm and having some sort of proving ground before you can to do that. That's why I was hoping that if we put this mechanism in place first, that you would ensure that at least the water is already, if a water reservation is already put in place, it might limit what type of work can be done on that stream or waterway that is put in place. And I know on my own research, I've also looked at the idea that there's the anadromous Fish Protection Act, and I'm not a lawyer. I understand there might be one or two in the building that could figure that out for the committee to see if irreparable harm is, if that's in conflict with the statute that's already put in place. I think that there are some conflicts there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any other questions from Mr. Sullivan? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next one up is it Guy or Mr. Archibald? Mr. Archibald. Is it Guy or Gary?
It's Guy.
Guy, okay.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Guy Archibald, and I'm the Mining and Clean Water Coordinator for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. And if I may I clarify the answer to Mr. Seaton's question?
Go ahead.
irreparable harm is not really well defined. I mainly deal with a lot of federal lands, and for instance, the Greens Creek mine right now has a draft EIS that calls for filling in the major portion of an Adirma salmon stream within the Admiralty Island National Monument, where they're mandated by Congress not to produce any harm to the salmon. The Forest Service does not see filling in that salmon stream with toxic tailings as being irreparable harm to the monument values. So I thought I'd clarify that. I was a little confused listening to Commissioner Sullivan's testimony, where he testified that the state of Alaska ranks, you know, second to the last in the world as far as producing permits for large projects, especially when I heard Doug Haight of the Department of Commerce Development Manager state that, quote, Alaska has a very favorable environment in the mining industry. There is actually evidence that answers that question. Every year, the Fraser Institute puts out a survey to over 5,000 international mining companies throughout the world, asking them various questions. This last year, over 800 companies responded to that survey. Those 800 companies were responsible for $6.3 billion of exploration funding in 2011. The results of that survey, Alaska ranked number 4 in the world in combined policy and mineral potential. That was compared to over 90 separate mining districts in the world. Other results from that survey, only 1% of respondents cited environmental regulations as being either a mild or strong deterrent in Alaska. Only 1% of the respondents thought that the tax regime, both the rate of tax and the complexity of the code, was either a mild or strong deterrent to permitting in Alaska. Part of the back problem with backlogging in permits is that there's no trigger for evaluation of a permit. Once a permit is applied for, DNR must process it. In the mining world, is full of a lot of speculation. Many of these companies are junior mining companies. Almost all of them apply for permits when they do not have a proven ore reserve. Their ore reserves are certified as an implied ore body. By definition, that means they have a zero certainty of an economic ore body. Yet they're applying for permits because getting those permits adds to the value of the project that they're trying to sell. So it's basically fueling speculation. I would ask that DNR just put a trigger level when a application is reviewed, say that the application will be reviewed when you submit the certification that you have a proven ore body. Those resources that aren't used on these mines that will never go into production then can be transferred and used for larger projects. And I think you would see the backlog of permits disappear. And then I will say one other note, that the state of Alaska did attempt a streamlining permit process once, and it was the Rock Creek mine north of Nome. They permitted it in less than 2 years because it was entirely on state land and did not require a NEPA process. The mine operated for 6 months. Shut down, the company walked away. The tailings pond immediately started filling full of water. DEC had to take emergency action to go in there and remedy the situation. The estimated cost for this cleanup is between $20 and $30 million. The mine was only bonded for $9.6 million. That difference is going to be picked up by us taxpayers. That was the one example of the attempt to streamline the permitting process. So I would ask that this bill not move forward, or if it do, it moves forward with significant amendments.
Questions for Mr. Archibald? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have specific ideas about these amendments that you're suggesting?
Well, I think that, first of all, an amendment to put a trigger for review in the anti-degradation world of water quality, there's a trigger level to reviewing an application. I say the same thing be put on not only for mines but any other type of project. How legitimate is the project to actually go into production before we're going to spend a bunch of state resources going through all the analysis and permitting and all that? And again, because I'm most familiar with it, the Greens Creek DEC cost the Forest Service, cost the Forest Service over $1 million to produce. But that's a producing mine, so you're going to get something out of that. But these other projects, it's speculation.
Thank you.
Representative Tupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's just a filter to get rid of all those projects that never intend to actually go into fruition and make sure we're focusing on the ones that are actually going to go somewhere. Is that the intent?
Yes. Many of these mines, because they're speculative, they'll put out a preliminary economic assessment for their investors. And they do this long before they have any certainty to their ore body. They have not done enough exploration. And there's a certification process for that. They go through a 401 certification where a third party will evaluate that and say, yes, this is indeed a legitimate, profitable, economical ore body or not.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's my understanding that we just don't let people go out and just do that here and there. We make them get permits to check for drillings, to see core drillings, to see if there's no way that most people can figure these out if they're profitable until they do a lot of this research. So they need permits to do the research, because we don't let them go out there and just do it free or for no reason. And so I don't know for sure how we would be able to do what you're saying. I know a lot of them only need 3 or 4 permits so that to help them decide whether it's going to be economical or not. But a lot of times that takes a lot of work and a lot of time to even get to the point where they can figure out if it's going to be economical.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, and that's very true. But these exploration permits are generally they're listed under what's called a categorical exclusion. The land manager estimates that this is such a small, the drilling impacts of such a small impact on the human health environment, that it's not worth the time or effort to assess it. So they give it what's called a categorical exclusion from further analysis. These permits are 2 or 3 pages long. It allows the company to go out and drill. I've seen those for up to 70 drill holes in a year. And there's some conditions on it. It's a conditional use permit, and it's good for that year. And they apply for them year after year after year. When they get to the point when they're actually now they're going to build a mill, they're going to build a tailings dam, they need a solid waste permit, it has to go through an air quality permit, a wastewater discharge permit, it reaches the level of review for DNR's large mine permitting program, which is the lead agency. And at that point, these EISs that come out that are thousands of pages long, where now they do have to examine the human health effects of all these different alternatives and all these impacted things like fish and wildlife and environmental justice communities. And that's where the cost comes in. That's the $1 million plus thing that costs and eats up a lot of time. I'm saying that's where the trigger needs to be put in. Okay, you've done your exploration, submit it for certification. Is this thing a worthwhile development or not? And given the fact that the price of gold nowadays, it's not going to take much to reach that threshold, mind you, for gold mining. other ones might, have a more difficult time, but at least you have some threshold there to winnow out legitimate projects versus ones that they're speculation. They're total speculation.
Well, a follow-up.
Go ahead.
I just have to beg to differ with you a little bit on that fact, because of the fact that it all depends on the price of metals. It depends on all kinds of things, and so something that might not be what you would call what you may call totally speculative may be totally in the running for being very economical 1 year, and the next year the price can change. So of the metals, which would then change it to be economical. But we can't foresee those things, and so we still have to be careful and still do all those things.
Through the chair. Yes, and I agree, and that's going to have to be up to some agency discretion there a little bit. But there are many examples of things, of mine projects that were beyond the pale of speculation. For instance, it was just less than 2 years ago, a company from Oklahoma staked 92 square miles of the Yakutat forelands and came out with the announcement that there was $34.5 billion worth of gold out there, more gold that's ever been mined in the history of the state of Alaska. And they also noted that there was issues with the chain of custody on the assay samples. Well, of course, nobody took that with any credibility. But in the meantime, their stock went way up, and the principals of the company made quite the dime selling their allocated 20,000 shares a quarter. It was pure speculation. And that's an egregious example, but there is a...
Thank you.
Any other members? Okay, thank you, Mr. Archibald.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Rebecca Siegel?
My name is Rebecca Siegel, and I live in Juneau, Alaska. I represent Alaskans for Responsible Mining, a statewide coalition of communities and conservation organizations. Mr. Chairman and members of the board, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I just want to say that ARM has thoroughly reviewed this bill, and we are against its passage. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you, Ms. Siegel.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify? All right, with that, we will go to folks online. First up, Mr. Rick Rogers from the Resource Development Council in Anchorage. Mr. Rogers.
Good afternoon. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes, sir, we can. Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you, co-chairs Feige and Sadler and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rick Rogers. I'm the executive director of the Resource Development Council. RDC is a statewide business association representing forestry, oil and gas, mining, tourism, fishing industries. All these industries are regulated and require authorizations from DNR in the course of their regular business. A top legislative priority of ours is to encourage the state to defend the integrity of its permitting processes and to advocate for predictable, timely, and efficient state and federal permitting based on sound science and economic feasibility. We support HB 77. We note that the Alaska legislature in prior sessions, to its credit, has provided DNR with additional resources to address what had become an untenable backlog of permits and authorizations. Such backlogs negatively affect all our resource industries as well as individual Alaskans seeking the many required state authorizations that DNR adjudicates. We understand that while the backlog still exists, the DNR has made some real progress in catching up on that work. Ramping up staff to adjudicate a backlog, however, is addressing the symptom rather than the going at the cause. And so systematic improvements to what has become a very complex set of statutes authorizing DNR's work is also needed to help prevent future backlog from building back up. The governor, with support of DNR Commissioner Sullivan and his staff, has identified specific means of improving the efficiency of our complex permitting system. The administration should be applauded for proposing numerous changes to the DNR enabling statutes in order to make their processes more timely and efficient. adapting our key DNR statutes to ensure we're adjudicating our land and resource authorizations in a more timely and efficient manner is overdue. We encourage this committee to support the administration's efforts to more efficiently manage DNR's tremendous workload, as the reach of this department affects a broad cross-section of Alaska businesses, resource industries, and individuals. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Questions from the committee? Representative Seed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first section of the bill allows granting of a general permit, and it seems like that increases the efficiency of certain activities. However, I wanted to ask you about the standard that's being used, so that if the activity is unlikely to result in significant harm, that makes sense to me. But do you believe the standard should be significant and irreparable harm as a standard for a general permit? I guess the question is, then if the harm is significant and could be repaired at some time or some place in the future be mitigated, then a general permit could be issued on the basis of, yes, it's significant harm, but it's not irreparable harm. And is that the standard that you think that we should be using for a general permit, or do you think that looking at it's unlikely to result in significant harm would be a better standard for all the industries across the state?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, my reading of the language says it's unlikely to result in significant or irreparable harm. So I guess it seems like a fairly reasonable standard by my reading. I do know from experience that, at least in the past, the department has used quite a bit of, they don't really issue general permits for all but the most innocuous type activities, and generally the general permits are the type of activities that aren't benefiting industry as much as individual Alaskans who are trying to get some more de minimis things done, like gathering, non-commercial forest products and that type of thing. But I think, I would defer to the commissioner's judgment. I don't think the general permits have been overused, and certainly they are a far more efficient tool. I don't think we want to see a situation where we've got Alaskans 1,000 deep in line to get permits for activities that a general permit would adequately protect the public interest.
And just follow up.
So, Representative.
I agree with you on the ability to have general permits, which we are putting in a new section of statute here. But so what I'm hearing you say is that that should be significant or irreparable harm, not a combination of the two, that it's significant and irreparable harm. If I'm reading you right, that's what I heard you say. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure that I'm hearing correctly his statement.
Hey, thank you, Representative Seaton. Representative Satter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rogers, a few minutes ago, a gentleman from SEAC made some representations about the impact of the state's permitting process in Alaska. Is it standing as a good place for mineral development? I just appreciate hearing any comments from your perspective, your organization's views on whether the current permitting process is helpful or harmful to Alaska's mineral industry.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. The permitting process is absolutely necessary for our mineral industry. We have to have one. But clearly, Alaska ranks near the bottom in terms of some of the time frames and some of the length of time it takes to permit some of these large projects. So I would suggest the argument that everything's fine and we don't need to work to improve our permitting systems is somewhat outrageous. Aside from the impact on industry, I would encourage the committee to also give consideration to the impact on the state, focusing this discussion on the mineral industry. While that is one affected industry with respect to DNR permits, I can't stress enough how far and wide the DNR reaches into the lives of everyday Alaskans. As you know, at statehood, Alaska received a statehood entitlement of about 106 million acres, as I recall, plus tidelands and submerged lands. So there are so many activities that require a DNR authorization, irrespective of the mining industry, that I would caution focusing all of the discussion on that one industry. But are there improvements that can be made? Of course there are, and I think even if we're in the top 5%, we should strive to be in the top 1% if we can do that and still protect the public interest, which we're all trying to do.
Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One quick point of clarity. I think when he mentioned, he said non-commercial forest products, I think he meant non-timber forest products, because I think those permits are actually generally for commercial application, or people would be selling those products commercially. But I just wanted to ask about the comment about using sound science, and I'll just show my bias here as a scientist and that background. In what way are you applying that standard, peer-reviewed scientific journals? What do you consider to be sound science? And if you can follow that up with any particular projects that you know would, you know, under if the circumstances that are changed under this bill would be moving forward at this time that are held up under the current permitting process.
Okay, so you had I appreciate the clarification on non-timber forest products. Thank you. So you had two questions, one about what we mean by sound science.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
Well, we think it's important that these decisions be made on the true costs and benefits and impacts to the environment. And so I think it's pretty clear. I mean, we don't want to be basing standards or permitting decisions on other than empirical evidence and the best available technology and the best understanding of how we can best develop our resources. So the second part of your question again?
Well, for example, I attended the Anchorage Chamber Make It Monday mining presentation. You know, they pass out a map of all of the projects that are underway now and making their way through the process. Under, you know, if you could talk about any specific project under the current permitting process, how that project would be streamlined under this bill, just as an example.
Okay, through the chair, thank you. I don't know that I can point to a specific project. I mean, I really think these are very incremental kind of tweaks to the DNR statutes. I wouldn't see this as kind of groundbreaking, earth-shattering changes that are just going to suddenly make it a whole lot simpler for businesses to get authorizations. But at the same time, I think it's worth supporting because the folks in DNR have looked hard, and they've looked into what are really, what, over 50 years worth of statutes and authorities for their very broad mission, and so they're finding little tweaks and little ways that'll improve things. You know, some of these things really in this bill are not going to affect the resource industries that I represent directly at all. For example, making it so you don't have to get a public notice to do a short plat of a piece of property in the unorganized borough where there's no easements, I don't really think that's earth-shaking for the mining or the oil and gas industry. But if it frees up some staff hours within DNR so that they can focus that time on something that's far more important to the state, then I think that makes sense for all our industries, and it's going to make it easier for the public to get things done, and frankly, it's going to perhaps have a little bit less budget pressure on what we all know are, you know, limited resources of the state. So, you know, I wouldn't characterize this as the end-all be-all or some sweeping reform or big change, but I think it's tweaking things, trying to make things clear, trying to make things more straightforward, and at the end of the day, hopefully, you know, I guess I just give deference to the professionals at DNR. If they think this is helpful, those people know in great detail far more than I think I ever want to understand how their statutes and systems work. But if they're telling us these changes are needed for them to be a little bit more efficient, then it's got my support.
Thank you.
We have one more presenter online. We have one more question.
I'll hold it if you would rather.
I was going to say, ask your question. I'm going to ask Mr. Rogers to respond by email, and we can pass his answer around to the rest of the committee. So,
okay,
please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick, Mr. Rogers, if you happen to have different statistics on where we rank on permitting, other than the commissioner's testimony and what we heard today, can you please provide that for us?
Okay.
All right.
Will do.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Rogers. And if you do have written your remarks written down, if you could please forward them to my office, we would appreciate that. And thank you for your testimony. Next up, Rachel Petro from the Anchorage, from the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce, or Alaska.
Hi, good afternoon, Co-Chairman Spidey and Sadler and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rachel Petro, and I'm actually the President and CEO of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce, of which the Anchorage Chamber and many local chambers are a member of. The Alaska Chamber is a statewide membership organization, and we're made up of all sizes and all types of businesses from across Alaska. The Alaska Chamber's primary mission is to advocate for policies that improve Alaska's business climate. Efficient, predictable, and common sense regulations and permitting processes are integral to creating an environment in which businesses, new and old, can succeed. And each fall, the Alaska Chamber members gather to set its legislative agenda for the following year. For the past several years in a row, including this year, the Alaska Chamber members have expressed very strong support for Alaska's policies and regulations that guide development of Alaska's natural resources while protecting our environment. At the same time, we've also advocated for streamlining those same regulations and policies where bureaucratic and business efficiencies can be gained. In regard to earlier testimony, in regard to the Fraser Institute study, internationally, Alaska actually ranks just below Kazakhstan and just above Colombia in regards to uncertainty concerning environmental regulations. And in regard to regulatory duplication and inconsistencies, Alaska actually ranks below Honduras and just above Niger. It's Alaska Chamber members believe that Alaska certainly can do better than these countries. The Alaska Chamber supports the provisions of House Bill 77 because they provide clarity, they eliminate unnecessary processes, and they modernize statutes based on the experience gained over many years from professional staff of the Department of Natural Resources. It's our belief that House Bill 77 is just a common sense piece of legislation, and as Mr. Rogers said earlier, not a magic bullet, but that it should actually just receive broad bipartisan support as mostly a cleanup bill. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify this afternoon.
Any questions for Ms. Petro? Excellent. Once again, Ms. Petro, if you could submit your written testimony, or if you do have any written remarks, please submit them to the committee. Looks like Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Briefly, Mrs. Petro, where in the hierarchy of the state chamber's priorities was permitting, where was permitting in the rank there? Was it top? Was it middle? The bottom?
Co-Chairman Sadler, thank you for the question. Actually, it ranked as our top, in our top three priorities. We have over 25 positions, and actually we're adding to those as the session goes on, but it was in our top three. So our members gather, they select all the positions, and then they vote on priorities, and this was number two, and it's been in the top for a long time.
And again, just to clarify, your membership is not just resource industry, that's all aspects of state business and economic activity, correct?
That is absolutely correct. We represent all sectors of the economy.
Thank you.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Ms. Petro, when you were talking about the Fraser Institute and environmental regulations, was there a separate statistic for permitting? Because we're trying to get on the permitting part of this. Did you happen to have that at your fingertips?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, I don't have the study right in front of me. It is readily available online, so I can't answer your question specifically. There, in the Fraser Institute study, there are multiple sub-rankings, and I referred to two. And I think Mr. Archibald referred to another one earlier today, or he was referencing, I think, Commissioner Sullivan. So I just wanted to let you know that in those two areas that I had at my fingertips, where we ranked. The Fraser Institute study is linked on our website, Representative, and you can look at it there or a Google search, or we can certainly forward you a copy.
Thank you very much, Ms. Petro. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions from committee? All right, we're about out of time here. At this time, we will not close public testimony. This bill will be held over till. Did you have a question? This bill will be held over until Friday. For members, is the chair's intent to begin accepting amendments starting with next Friday's meeting? Time now is 3 o'clock.
This Friday.
This Friday.
Did I say that?
You said next Friday.
Next Friday.
Oh, this Friday.
Okay.
Thank you for catching that. So at the next meeting, which will be on this Friday. At 1 o'clock. Time now is 3 o'clock, and we're adjourned.